involved with the House of Horror? Or was Wick Sax our man? Was he Casanova?
You're the big guru.
Davy Sykes was suddenly leaning over my shoulder.
Who is he, my man? Help us local yokels out. Catch the bogeyman, Dr. Cross.
Chapter 89. Late that night, Casanova was on the move again. He was hunting again. He had missed the thrill these last few days, but this was going to be an important night. He easily penetrated the security of the sprawling Duke University Medical Center complex through a little-used gray metal door in the private parking area reserved for doctors. On the way to his appointed destination, he passed several chirping nurses and serious-faced young doctors. Some of the doctors and nurses nodded and even smiled at him. As always, Casanova fit in perfectly with the surroundings. He could go anywhere, and he usually did. As he hurried down the sterile white hospital corridors, his head was busy figuring out complicated, important calculations about his future. He had a hugely successful run here in the Research Triangle area and the Southeast, but it was definitely drawing to an end, starting tonight. Alex Cross and the other dreary plotters were getting too close to him. Even the Durham police were becoming dangerous. He was a territorial wreck. He knew their inadequate terminology for him. Eventually, someone would find the house. Or worse, someone would probably find him through dumb luck. Yes, it was time to move on. Maybe he and Will Rudolph should go to New York City, he thought. Or sunny Florida, which had drawn Ted Bundy. Arizona might be pleasant. Spend the fall season in Tempe or Tucson, bustling college towns filled to bursting with prey. Or maybe they could settle in near one of the huge campuses in Texas. Austin was supposed to be nice. Or Urbana, Illinois. Madison, Wisconsin. Columbus, Ohio. He was leaning toward Europe, actually, either London, Munich, or Paris. His version of the Grand Tour. Maybe that was the right concept for the times, a truly Grand Tour for the whiz kids. Who needed to go watch Dracula when there were real monsters roaming the countryside day and night? Casanova wondered if anyone had managed to follow him into the medical center maze. How about Alex Cross? It was a possibility. Dr. Cross had relatively impressive staying power. He had bested that unimaginative child molester, that garden-variety psycho-killer up in D.C. Cross had to be eliminated before he and Will Rudolph left the area for bigger and better things. Otherwise, Cross would follow them to hell and back. Casanova passed into Building 2 of the Byzantine hospital maze. This was the way to the hospital morgue and maintenance, so the foot traffic was usually lighter. He peered down the long off-white corridor behind him. No followers. No one willing to lead in this gutless, witless age, either. Maybe they didn't know about him yet. Maybe they hadn't figured anything out. But they would eventually. There were clues. It could all be traced back to Roe Tierney and Tom Hutchinson. The unsolved golden couple murder. The very beginning for him and Will Rudolph. God, he was glad his friend was back. Rudolph always made him feel better when he was around. Rudolph truly understood desire and ultimately freedom. Rudolph understood him as no one else ever had. Casanova began to jog down a brightly polished corridor into Building 2 of the medical center. As he quickened his pace, the sound of his slapping footsteps echoed in the empty halls. In a few minutes, he was in Building 4, all the way over on the northwest side of the hospital. He looked back one more time. Nobody had followed. Nobody had guessed right yet. Maybe they never would. Casanova came out into the brightly lit, almost orangish parking area. A black Jeep was parked close to the building, and he nonchalantly climbed inside. The vehicle had MD plates, state of North Carolina. Yet another of his masks. He was feeling strong and sure of himself again. He felt wonderfully free and alive tonight. This was exhilarating. It could be one of his finest hours, actually. He felt as if he could fly through the silky black night. He took off to claim his victim. Dr. Kate McTiernan was next again. He missed her so much. He loved her. Chapter 90. The gentleman caller was on the move. Dr. Will Rudolph passed inexorably through the night toward his unsuspecting prey. His juices were surging, sloshing. He was going to make a house call, as an outstanding doctor should, at least a doctor who really cared. Casanova didn't want him out roaming the streets of Durham or Chapel Hill. He'd forbidden it, in fact. Understandable enough. Admirable, but not possible. They were working together again. Besides, the danger was minimal at night, and the rewards far exceeded the risks. This next scene in the drama had to be done just right, and he was the one to do it. Will Rudolph was certain of that. He had no emotional baggage, no Achilles' heel. Casanova did. Her name was Kate McTiernan. In a strange way, he thought, she had become his competition. Casanova had bonded with her in a special way. She was very close to the lover he claimed to be obsessively searching for. As such, she was dangerous to his own special relationship with Casanova. As he drove into Chapel Hill, he thought about his friend. Something was different, and even more satisfying between them now. Being torn apart for almost a year made him appreciate the strange relationship. It was more powerful than ever. There was no one else he could talk to, not one person. How very sad, Rudolph thought. How droll. During his year in California, Will Rudolph had remembered all too well the searing loneliness he had experienced as a boy. He'd grown up at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, then in Asheville. He was a bird colonel's boy, an army brat, a true son of the South. Right from the beginning, he had been clever enough to keep up a facade. Honor student, polite, helpful, social graces to beat all. The perfect gentleman. No one had guessed the truth about his desires and needs, which was exactly why the loneliness had been so unbearable. He knew when the loneliness had ended, exactly when and where. He remembered the first dizzying meeting with Casanova. It had taken place right on the Duke campus, and it was a dangerous meeting for both of them. The gentleman remembered the scene so well. He had a small room, like any other student on campus. Casanova had shown up one night, well past midnight, closer to 2. Scared the shit out of him. He seemed so sure of himself when Rudolph opened the door and saw him there. There was a theatrical suspense movie called Rope. The scene reminded him of the movie. "You going to invite me in? I don't think you want what I have to say broadcast out here in a public hallway." Rudolph had let him in, shut the door. His heart was thundering. "What do you want? It's almost 2 in the morning. Christ." The smile again, so cocksure, knowing. "You killed Roe Tierney and Thomas Hutchinson. You were stalking her for over a year. You have a loving remembrance of Roe right here in this room. Her tongue, I believe." It was the most dramatic moment of Will Rudolph's life. Someone actually knew who he was. Someone had found him out. "Don't be frightened. I also know there's no way they'll ever prove you committed the murders. You committed perfect crimes. Well, near perfect. Congratulations." Acting as well as he could under the circumstances, Rudolph had laughed in his accuser's face. "You're completely out of your mind. I'd like you to leave now. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard." "Yes, it is," the accuser said. "But you've been waiting to hear it all your life." "Let me tell you something else you've wanted to hear. I understand what you did and why. I've done it myself. I'm a lot like you, Will." Rudolph had felt a powerful connection immediately. The first real human connection of his life. Perhaps that was what love was. Did ordinary people feel so much more than he did? Or were they deluding themselves, creating grandiose, romantic fantasies around the mundane exchange of seminal fluids. He was at his final destination before he knew it. He stopped the car under a towering old elm and switched off the headlamps. Two black men were standing on the porch of Kate McTiernan's house. One of them was Alex Cross. Chapter 91. At a little past 10, Samson and I rode down a dark, winding street on the outskirts of Chapel Hill. It had been a long day in the tank for both of us. I'd taken Samson to meet Seth Samuel Taylor earlier that evening. We'd also spoken to one of Seth's former teachers, Dr. Louis Freed. I gave Dr. Freed my theory about the disappearing house. He agreed to help me with some important research for the investigation on where it might be located. I hadn't told Samson too much about Kate McTiernan yet. It was time for them to meet, though. I didn't know exactly what our friendship was about, and neither did Kate. Maybe Samson could add a few thoughts after he saw her. I was sure he would. "You working late hours like this every night?" Samson wanted to know as we eased down Kate's street, Old Lady's Lane, as she called it. "Until I find Scoochie or admit that I can't," I told him. "Then I plan to take a whole night off." Samson chortled. "You devil, you." We hopped out of the car and went to the door. I rang the bell.
"No key?" Samson deadpanned.
Kate flipped on the outdoor light for us. I wondered why she didn't keep it on all the time. Because she would save 5 cents a month if she didn't use the light? Because the light would attract bugs? Because she was stubborn and maybe wanted another shot at Casanova? That was more like it, knowing Kate the way I was starting to. She wanted Casanova as badly as I did. She came to the door in an old gray sweatshirt, tattered holy jeans, bare feet with playfully red toenails. Her dark hair was bobbed at shoulder length, and she looked beautiful. No getting away from that. "It's like a damn bug house out here," Kate commented as she looked around her porch. She hugged me and gave me a kiss on the cheek. I had a thought about the two of us holding each other the night before. Where was this going, I wondered. Did it have to be going anywhere? "Ah, John Sampson," she greeted him with a pumping handshake. "I know a few things about you ever since you two met when you were 10. You can fill me in on the rest over a cold beer or two. Tell your side." She smiled then. It always felt good to be on the other side of one of her smiles.
"So you're the famous Kate," Samson held onto her hand, and stared into the deep pools of her brown eyes. "I hear you worked your way through medical school at a truck stop, or some such apocryphal nonsense. Second-degree black belt, too. A Nidan."
He started to smile and bowed respectfully. Kate grinned at Samson as she bowed back. "Come in out of the eternal bugs and the infernal heat. Looks like Alex has been talking behind our backs. We'll get him for that. Let's both gang up on him." "That's Kate," I said to Samson as I followed him inside. "What do you think?" He looked back at me.
"She likes you for some strange reason. She even likes me, which makes a lot more sense."
We sat in her kitchen, and the talk was easy and comfortable, the way it usually was around her. Samson and I drank beer, and Kate had several iced teas. I could tell that Kate and Samson liked each other fine. There was nothing not to like about either of them. They were both independent spirits, very smart, generous. I filled her in on our latest day of detective work, our disappointing meeting with Ruskin and Sykes, and she told us about her day at the hospital, even some verbatims from her off-service notes.
"Sounds like you have an eidetic memory to go along with the black belt," Samson said, with a raised eyebrow about the size of a boomerang. "No wonder Dr. Alex is so impressed with you."
"You are?" Kate gave me a look.
"Well, you never told me that."
"Kate, believe it or not, is not self-centered enough," I told Samson. "Rare, rare disease in our quarter century. It's because she doesn't watch much TV. She reads too many books instead."
"It's not polite to analyze your friends in front of your other friends," Kate said to me with a little slap on the arm.
We talked about the case some more. About Dr. Wick Sachs and his head games. About harems, the masks, the disappearing house. My newest theory involving Dr. Louis Freed.
I was doing some light reading before you got here, Kate told us. An essay on the male sexual urge, the natural beauty and power of it. It's about modern men trying to distance themselves from their mothers, from the smothering, cosmological mom. It proposes that many men want the freedom to assert their masculine identities, but contemporary society continually frustrates that. Comments, gentlemen?
Men will be men. Samson showed his big white teeth. Good case in point. We're still lions and tigers at heart. Never met a cosmological mom, so I won't comment on that part of your essay.
What do you think, Alex? Kate asked me. Are you a lion or a tiger?
I have never liked certain things about most men, I said. We are incredibly repressed, monochromatic because of it. Insecure, defensive. Rudolph and Sachs are asserting their masculinity to the extreme. They refuse to be repressed by society's mores or laws.
Ba-dum-bum. Samson did a talk show drumbeat for me.
They think they're smarter than everyone else, Kate said. At least Casanova does. He laughs at all of us. He's a nasty son of a bitch.
And that's why I'm here, Samson told her. To catch him and put him in a cage and lock the cage on a far mountaintop. And by the way, he'd be stone dead in the cage anyway.
The time passed like that. Flashed by real quickly. Finally, it was getting late and we had to leave. I tried to talk Kate into staying at a hotel for the night. We had been over this subject repeatedly, and her answer was always the same.
Thanks for the concern, but no thanks, she said as she brought us out onto the porch. I can't let him chase me out of my own house. That will not happen. He comes back, we tangle.
Alex is right about the hotel, Samson said to her in the gentle voice he reserves for friends. There it was, a double recommendation from two of the sharpest cops around.
Kate shook her head, and I knew there was no sense in arguing with her anymore.
Absolutely not. I'll be just fine, I promise, she said.
I didn't ask Kate if I could stay, but I wanted to. I didn't know if Kate even wanted me to stay. It was a little complicated with Samson there. I suppose I could have given him my car to drive back, but it was already after 1:30. We all needed to get some sleep anyway. Samson and I finally left.
Very nice. Very interesting woman. Very smart. Not your type, Samson said as we pulled away from the house. From him, it was a rare rave review. My type, he added.
When we reached the end of the block, I turned and looked back at the house. It was cooler now, in the low 70s, and Kate had already turned off the porch light and gone in. She was stubborn, but she was smart. It had gotten her through med school. It had gotten her past the deaths of people she loved. She would be okay. She always had been. I called Kyle Craig when I got back to the hotel, though.
How's our man Sachs? I asked him.
He's just fine. He's all tucked in for the night. Not to worry.
Chapter 92. After the good ship Alex and Samson left, Kate carefully checked and double-checked all the doors and windows to her apartment. They were securely locked. She had liked Samson right away. He was huge and scary, nice and scary, sweet and scary. Alex had brought his closest friend to see her, and she liked that. As she did her rounds, her safety check of home sweet home, she ruminated about a new life, far away from Chapel Hill, far away from everything terrifying and bad that had happened here. Hell, I'm living a Hitchcock movie, she thought. If Alfred Hitchcock had stayed alive long enough to see and react to the madness and horror of the 1990s. Exhausted, she finally climbed into bed. Yuck. She felt stale bread or cake crumbs against her legs. She hadn't made the bed that morning. She wasn't accomplishing much lately, and that made her angry, too. She'd been on a proper schedule to complete her intern year this spring. Now she didn't know if she'd make it by the end of summer. Kate pulled the covers up under her chin. In early June. She was getting so buggy. Her anxiety wasn't going to stop while the monster Casanova was on the loose out there, she knew. She thought about killing him. Her first and only violent fantasy. She imagined going to Wick Sax's house. An eye for an eye. She remembered the appropriate passage from the Book of Exodus. Eidetic memory right. She really wished that Alex had stayed, but she didn't want to embarrass him in front of Samson. She wanted to talk to Alex the way they always did, and she wished he was with her now. She wanted to be in his arms tonight. Maybe more than just in Alex's arms. Maybe she was ready for more. One night at a time. She wasn't sure what she believed in anymore, or if she believed in anything at all. She was praying lately, so maybe she did believe. Wrote prayers, but prayers all the same. Our Father who art, Hail Mary full of. She wondered if a lot of people did the same thing. I do love the idea of you, God, she finally whispered. Please love the idea of me back. She couldn't stop obsessing about Casanova, about Dr. Wick Sax, about the mysterious disappearing house of horror and the poor women still trapped there. But she was so used to the continuous, terrifying nightmares that she finally drifted off to sleep anyway. Kate never heard him come into the house. Chapter 93.
Tick-cock, tick-cock, tickery, dickery, cock.
Kate finally heard a noise. A floorboard creaked on the right side of the bedroom. Tiny, tiny sound, but unmistakable. That wasn't her imagination, wasn't a dream. She sensed that he was there in her bedroom again. Let it be a crazy thought. Let it be a scene in a nightmare. Let this whole past month be a nightmare I'm having. Oh, Jesus. Oh, God, no, she thought. He was in her room. He'd come back. This was so bad that she couldn't make herself believe it was happening. Kate held her breath until her chest ached and threatened to cave in. She never really believed he would come back. Now she realized that was a terrible mistake. The worst of her life, but not the last one she was allowed, she hoped. Who was this extraordinary madman? Did he hate her so much that he would risk everything? Or did he think he loved her so much? The sick, pathetic bastard. She sat tensely on the edge of the bed and listened intently for another sound. She was ready to spring at him. There it was again, a tiny creak. It was coming from the right side of the room. Finally, she could see the full, dark silhouette of his body. She gulped in air greedily and almost gagged. There he was, God damn him to hell. A powerful, hateful energy like currents of electricity surged between them. Their eyes finally met. Even in the darkness, his eyes seemed to burn through her. She remembered his eyes so well. Kate tried to roll away from him, from his first strike. The blow came fast and hard. He hadn't lost his quickness. Excruciating pain ripped through her shoulder and down her left side. Karate training kept her moving somehow. Sheer stubbornness, a will to live that was becoming her trademark. She was off the bed, up on her feet, ready for him. "Mistake," she whispered. "Yours this time." She saw the outline of a body again, this time against the moonlight, streaming in a bedroom window. Fear and loathing gripped Kate. Her heart felt as if it might stop, just pack it in on her. She fired a powerful kick, hit him hard in the face, and heard the crunch of bone. It was horrifying, yet wonderful to hear. A high-pitched voice shrieked out in pain. She'd heard him. "Now do it again, Kate." She bobbed, moved, kicked hard at the dark, shifting body, striking the stomach area. Again he grunted in pain. "How do you like it?" Kate screamed at him. "How do you like it?" She had him, and Kate vowed that she wasn't going to lose this time. She was going to capture Casanova all by herself. He was ripe for the catching. First she was going to hurt him, though. She punched him again, short, compact, lightning-fast and powerful, satisfying beyond anything she could imagine. He was staggering, moaning out loud. His head snapped back hard. His hair flew out. She wanted him down, on the floor, maybe unconscious. Then she would turn on a light. Then she just might kick him while he was down. "That was a love tap," she told him. "Just a start."
She watched him stumble in front of her. He was going down. Woof! Something, someone, struck her square in the back. The blow knocked all the breath out of her. She couldn't believe she'd been blindsided. Pain rushed through her body as if she'd been shot. Woof! It happened again. There were two of them in her bedroom. Chapter 94. Kate was in shocking pain, but she stayed on her feet, and finally she saw the second man in her bedroom. He swung hard and struck her in the forehead. She heard a metallic ring and felt herself falling, toppling. Felt herself vaporizing, actually. Then her body bounced off the wooden floorboards. Two voices were floating above her. Two monsters inside her bedroom. Stereo nightmares. "You shouldn't be here," she recognized Casanova's voice. He was talking to the second intruder, the demon behind door number two. "Dr. Will Rudolph?" "Yes, I'm the one who should be here. I'm not involved with this stupid bitch, am I? I couldn't care less about her. Think it through. Be smart." All right, Will. What do you want to do with her?" Casanova spoke again. "This is your show. Isn't that what you want?"
"Personally, I'd like to eat her a nibble at a time," said Dr. Will Rudolph. "Is that too extreme?"
They kept laughing like two buddies talking at a sports bar. Kate felt herself fading away from the scene. She was leaving. Where was she going? Will Rudolph said that he bought her flowers. They both began to laugh at the joke. They were hunting together again. No one could stop them. Kate could smell their body odor, a strong male musk that seemed to combine into an overpowering presence. She stayed conscious for a long time. She fought with all her strength. She was stubborn, willful, proud as hell. The light finally went out for her, like a tube in an old-fashioned TV set. A blurry picture, then a small dot of light, then blackness. It was that simple, that prosaic. They turned on the bedroom lights when they were finished, so that all of Kate McTiernan's admirers could have a last good look at her. Murdered beyond cold blood. Chapter 95. My arms and legs were shaking uncontrollably as I tried to drive the 5 miles or so from Durham to Chapel Hill. Even my teeth were chattering, hitting together hard. I finally had to pull off Chapel Hill-Durham Boulevard, where I thought I would probably crash the car. I sat slumped in the front seat with the car headlamps shining across dancing dust motes and light-crazed insects that hovered in the early morning air. I took deep breath after deep breath, trying to suck in some sanity. It was past 5 in the morning, and the birds were already singing away. I put my hands over my ears to shut out their songs. Samson was still asleep back at the hotel. I'd forgotten that he was there. Kate had never been afraid of Casanova. She trusted in her ability to take care of herself, even after her abduction. I knew that it was irrational and crazy to blame myself, but I did. Somewhere, at the same time, during the past few years, I had stopped behaving like a professional police detective. There was some good in that, but in a way it was bad. There was too much pain on the job, if you let yourself feel it. That was the surest, fastest way to burn out. I eventually eased the car back onto the road. About 15 minutes later, I was at the familiar clabbered house in Chapel Hill. "Old Lady's Lane," Kate had dubbed the street. I could see her face, her sweet, easy smile, her enthusiasm and conviction about things that mattered to her. I could still hear her voice. Samson and I had been at this house less than 3 hours ago. My eyes were tearing, my brain screaming. I was losing control. I remembered one of the last things she'd said to me. I could hear Kate's voice. "He comes back, we tangle." Black and white police cruisers, somber-looking EMS vans, and TV trucks were already parked everywhere on the narrow two-lane blacktop street. They were filling every available space. I was sick to death of the sight of crime scenes. It looked as if half the town of Chapel Hill was congregated outside Kate's apartment.
In the early morning light, all the faces looked pale and grim. They were shocked and angry. This was supposed to be a gentle college town, liberal thinking, a safe haven from the whirling chaos and madness of the rest of the world. That was why most people chose to live here. But it wasn't like that anymore. Casanova had changed that forever. I fumbled on a pair of dusty and stained sunglasses that had been sitting on the dash of the car for months. They were Samson's shades originally. He'd given them to Damon, so he could look as tough as Samson whenever I gave him any trouble. I needed to look tough right now. Chapter 96. I began to walk toward Kate's house on unsure, rubbery legs. Maybe I looked like the toughest motherfucker around, but my heart was heavy and incredibly fragile. News photographers snapped my picture again and again. The camera flashes sounded like hollow, muffled gunshots. Reporters approached, but I waved them off. "Keep back, man," I finally warned a couple of them. Serious warning. "This is not the time. Not now." But I noticed that even the reporters and cameramen looked dazed and confused and shocked. Both the FBI and the Durham PD were at the scene of the unspeakable, cowardly attack. I saw a lot of local policemen. Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes had come down from Durham. Sykes gave me the evil eye, like what did I think I was doing here? Kyle Craig was already at the scene. He had personally called me at the hotel to give me the terrible news. Kyle came up to me and he put his arm around my shoulder, spoke to me in a low whisper. "She's very bad, Alex. But she's hanging in somehow. She must want to live very, very much. They should be bringing her out any minute now. Stay out here with me. Don't go inside. Trust me on this, will you?" I listened to Kyle's words, and I was afraid I was going to break down in front of all the cameras, all the strangers, and the few people I knew. My head, my heart, it was all whirling chaos. I finally went inside the house, and I looked at as much as I could bear. He had come into our bedroom again. He had been right there. Something was wrong, though. Something didn't track in straight lines for me. Something. What was wrong here? The emergency team from Duke Medical Center put Kate on a stretcher, the kind used for broken backs and severe head injuries. I don't think I'd ever seen anyone carried so delicately, under any tragic circumstances. The doctors looked ashen as they began to carry her out of the house. The crowd became suddenly hushed when the EMS crew appeared outside. "They're bringing her to the Duke Medical Center. You'll get some arguments from the university people, but that's the best facility in the state," Al told me. He was trying to be reassuring in his soothing, mechanical man way. Actually, he was surprisingly good at it. Something was wrong. Something was all out of kilter. Think. Focus your thoughts somehow. This could be important. But I couldn't think in straight lines. Not yet I couldn't. "What about Wick Sacks?" I asked Kyle.
"He got home before 10 o'clock. He's there now. We don't know that he didn't go out for sure, I suppose. He could have slipped out past us somehow. Maybe he has a way out of the house. I don't think so, though."
I moved away from Kyle Craig and went over to one of the white-coated Duke University doctors near the ambulance. Camera flashes were erupting everywhere around us. Hundreds of memorable pictures were being taken by the nightcrawlers at the crime scene. "Can I ride with her?" The EMS doctor very gently shook his head at me. "No, sir," he said. He seemed to be talking in slow motion. "No, sir. Only the family can ride in the ambulance. I'm sorry, Dr. Cross." "I'm her family tonight," I said. I pushed past him and climbed into the rear of the ambulance. He didn't try to stop me. He couldn't have, anyway. I felt numb all over. Kate lay amid the solemn monitoring and resuscitation equipment in the close quarters of the rescue ambulance. I was afraid that she had died as I was getting into the ambulance, or when they were carrying her outside. I sat beside Kate and held just the tips of her fingers. "It's Alex. I'm here for you," I whispered to her. "Be strong right now. You're so strong anyway. Be strong now." The same doctor who had told me I couldn't get into the ambulance came in and sat next to me. He felt obliged to tell me the rules, but he didn't care to enforce them. His name tag said Dr. B. Stringer,
Duke University EMS team. I owed him a big favor. Can you tell me anything about Kate's chances? I asked as the emergency ambulance slowly pulled away from the nightmare scene in Chapel Hill.
That's a tough question, I'm afraid. She's alive, and that's a miracle in itself.
He spoke in a low, respectful voice.
There are multiple fractures and contusions, some open gashes in them. Both cheekbones are fractured. She may have a sprained neck. She must have played dead on him. Somehow she had the presence of mind to trick him.
Kate's face was swollen badly and cut. She was almost unrecognizable. I knew the same was true all over her body. I clung gently to Kate's hand as the ambulance sped toward Duke Medical Center.
She had the presence of mind to trick him.
That was Kate, all right.
I wondered, though.
I held on to another mind-blowing thought. It had hit me hard outside the house.
I thought I knew what had been wrong in Kate's bedroom.
Will Rudolph had been in the bedroom, hadn't he? The gentleman caller had been there for the attack. He had to be the one. It was his style. Extreme, graphic violence. Rage. There was little evidence of Casanova, no artistic touches. There was such extraordinary violence, though.
They were twinning. Two monsters bonding to make one.
Perhaps Rudolph resented Kate because Casanova had loved her. Maybe she had come between them in his twisted perception. Maybe they had left Kate alive on purpose, so she could be a vegetable for the rest of her life.
They were working together now, weren't they?
There were two of them to catch, to stop. Chapter 97. The FBI and Durham police decided to bring Dr. Wick-Sachs in for questioning early the next morning. This was a big deal, a pivotal decision in the case. A special investigator was flown down from Virginia to do the delicate interrogation. He was one of the FBI's best, a man named James Heakin. He questioned Sachs throughout most of the morning. I sat with Sampson, Kyle Craig, and Detectives Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes. We watched the interrogation through a two-way mirror inside Durham Police Headquarters. I felt like a starving man with his nose pressed against the window of an expensive restaurant. But there was no food being served inside. The FBI interrogator was good, very patient, and as crafty as a star district attorney. But so was Wick-Sachs. He was articulate, extremely cool under verbal fire, even smug. "This fucker's going down," Davy Sykes finally said inside the quiet observation room. It was good to see that he and Ruskin cared, at least. In a way, I could empathize with them in their role as local detectives. They had been on the outside looking in for most of the frustrating investigation. "What do you have on Sachs? Tell me if you're holding anything back," I said to Nick Ruskin at the coffee machine. "We brought him in because our chief of police is an asshole," Ruskin told me. "We don't have anything on Sachs yet." I wondered if I could believe Ruskin or anyone else connected with this case. After nearly 2 hours of tense parrying back and forth, Agent Heakin's interrogation had established little more than Sachs was a collector of erotica and that he'd been promiscuous with consenting students and professors over the last 11 years at the university. As much as I had wanted to bust Sachs, I couldn't really understand why he'd been brought in at this time. Why now? "We found out where his money comes from," Kyle told me part of the answer that morning. "Sachs is the owner of an escort service working out of Raleigh and Durham. The service is called Kismet. Interesting name. They advertise lingerie modeling in the Yellow Pages. At the least, Dr. Sachs will have some serious problems with internal revenue. Washington decided we should apply pressure now. They're afraid he's going to run soon." "I don't agree with your people in Washington," I told Kyle. I knew that some agents called headquarters up there Disneyland East. I could see why. They could be risking the investigation right now and by remote control.
"Who does agree with Washington?" Kyle said, and shrugged his wide, bony shoulders. It was his way of admitting that he wasn't in full control anymore. The case was too big now. "By the way, how is Kate McTiernan doing?" he asked. I had already been on the phone 3 times with Duke Medical Center that morning.
They had a number from me at the Durham station in case Kate's condition changed. She's listed as grave, but she's still hanging in there, I told Kyle. I got the chance to talk to Wick Sachs just before 11 o'clock that morning. It was Kyle's concession to me. I tried to put Kate out of my mind before I had to be in the same room with Sachs. Anger thundered and roared inside my body all the same. I didn't know if I could control myself. I wasn't even sure if I wanted to anymore.
Let me do this one, Alex. Let me go in there with him.
Sampson held my arm before I went inside. I broke away from him and went to meet Dr. Wick Sachs. I'm going to do him. Chapter 98. Hello, Dr. Sachs. The lighting in the small, impersonal interrogation room was even brighter and harsher than it had looked from behind the two-way mirror. Sachs was red-eyed, and I could tell he was as tense as I was. His skin looked stretched taut over his skull. But he was as confident and smug with me as he'd been with James Heakin of the FBI. Was I looking into the eyes of Casanova, I wondered? Could he possibly be the human monster? My name is Alex Cross, I said as I slumped down on a shop-worn metal chair. Naomi Cross is my niece. Sachs spoke through gritted teeth. He had a mild drawl. According to Kate, Casanova had no noticeable accent.
I know who the hell you are. I read the newspapers, Dr. Cross. I don't know your niece. I read that she was abducted.
I nodded. If you read the papers, you must also be aware of the handiwork of the scum who calls himself Casanova. Sachs smirked. At least it looked like that to me. His blue eyes were filled with contempt. It was easy to see why he was widely disliked at the university. His blonde hair was slicked back, not a strand out of place. His horn-rimmed glasses helped make him seem officious and condescending.
There is no record of violence anywhere in my past. I could never commit those horrifying murders. I can't even kill palmetto bugs in my house. My aversion to violence is well documented.
I'll bet it is, I thought. All of your clever fronts and facades are neatly, perfectly in place, aren't they? Your devoted wife, the nurse, your two children, your well-documented aversion to violence. I rubbed my face with both my hands. It took all of my strength to keep from hitting him. He remained haughty and unapproachable. I leaned across the table and spoke in a whisper. I looked through your erotic book collection. I was there in your basement, Dr. Sachs. The collection's full of perverse sexual violence. The physical degradation of men, women, and children. That might not constitute a record of violence, but it gives me some subtle hints about your true character. Sachs dismissed what I said with a wave of his hand. I'm a noted philosopher and sociologist. Yes, I study eroticism, just as you study the criminal mind. I don't suffer from libertine dementia, Dr. Cross. My erotic collection is the key to my understanding the fantasy life of Western culture, the escalating war between men and women. His voice level went up. I also don't have to explain any of my private affairs to you. I've broken no laws. I'm here voluntarily. You, on the other hand, entered my house without a search warrant. I tried to keep Sachs off balance by asking him about something else. Why do you think you're so successful with young women? We already know about your sexual conquests of students at the university. 18, 19, 20-year-olds. Beautiful young women. Your own students, in some cases. There's a record of that, certainly. For a moment, his anger surfaced. Then he caught himself and did something odd and maybe very revealing. Sachs showed his need to exert power and control, to be the star of the show, even to me, insignificant as I was to him. Why am I successful with women, Dr. Cross? Sachs smiled, and he let his tongue play between his teeth. The message was subtle, but also clear. Sachs was telling me that he knew how to sexually control most women. He continued to smile, an obscene smile from an obscene man. Many women want to be freed from their sexual inhibitions, especially young women, the modern women on campuses. I free them. I free as many women as I possibly can.
That did it. I was across the table in a second. Sax's chair tumbled over backwards. I landed heavily on top of him. He grunted in pain. I pressed my body down hard on his. My arms and legs were shaking. I held back from actually throwing a punch. He was absolutely powerless to stop me, I realized. He didn't know how to fight back. He wasn't very strong or athletic. Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes were inside the interrogation room in a flash, and Kyle and Samson were right behind them. They jammed into the room and tried to pull me off Sykes. Actually, I pulled myself away from Wick Sykes. I didn't hurt him, never intended to. I whispered to Samson, "He isn't physically strong. Casanova is. He isn't the monster. He isn't Casanova." Chapter 99. That night, Samson and I had dinner together at a pretty good spot in Durham. Ironically, it was called Nana's. Neither of us was especially hungry. The overly large steaks with shallots and mountains of garlic mashed potatoes went to waste. It was late in the game with Casanova, and we seemed to be falling all the way back to square one. We talked about Kate. I had been told by hospital officials that her condition was still poor. If she lived, the doctors believed that she had little chance of full recovery, of ever being a doctor again.
"You two were more than, you know, good friends?" Samson finally asked. He was gentle with his probing, the way he can be when he wants to.
I shook my head. "No, we were friends, John. I could talk to her about anything, and in ways I'd mostly forgotten. I had never been so comfortable with a woman so quickly, except maybe for Maria." Samson nodded a lot, and mostly listened to me air it all out. He knew who I was, past and present. My beeper sounded while we were still pushing around the generous portions of food on our plates. I called Kyle Craig from a phone downstairs in the restaurant. I reached him in his car. He was on his way to Hope Valley.
"We're about to arrest Wick Sykes for the Casanova murders," he said.
I almost dropped the receiver.
"You're about to what?"
I shouted into the phone. I couldn't believe what I had just heard.
"When the hell is this going to happen?" I asked. "When was the decision made? Who made it?"
Kyle kept as cool as always. The Iceman. "We're going into the house in the next couple of minutes. This time it's the Durham Police Chief's game. Something was found in the house. Physical evidence. It will be a joint arrest, the Bureau in cooperation with the Durham PD. I wanted you to know, Alex."
"He's not Casanova," I said to Kyle. "Don't take him down. Don't arrest Wick Sykes."
The level of my voice was high. The payphone was in a narrow corridor of the restaurant, and people were filing in and out of nearby restrooms. I was drawing stares, both angry and fearful looks.
"It's a done deal," Kyle said.
"I'm sorry about it myself." Then he hung up the car phone on me. End of discussion. Samson and I rushed to Sax's house in the Durham suburbs. Man Mountain was quiet at first. Then he asked the $64,000 question.
"Could they have enough to convict without you knowing anything?"
It was a tough question for me. His meaning, how out of the loop was I? "I don't think Kyle has enough for an arrest now," he would have told me. "The Durham PD? I don't know what the hell they're up to. Ruskin and Sykes have been off doing their own thing. We've been in their position ourselves." When we arrived in Hope Valley, I found out that we weren't the only ones who had been called to the arrest scene. The quiet suburban street was blocked off. Several TV station trucks and minivans were already there. Police cruisers and FBI sedans were parked everywhere.
"This is really fucked up. Looks like a block party," Samson said as we got out of the car. "Worst I've seen, I think. Worst screw-up."
"It has been from the beginning," I agreed. "A multi-jurisdictional nightmare." I was shaking like a wino in winter on a D.C. street. I had taken one body blow after another. Nothing completely made sense to me anymore. How out of the loop was I? Kyle Craig saw me coming. He walked up to me and firmly grabbed my arm.
I had the feeling he was ready to body block me if necessary. "I know how damn upset you are, so am I," were his first words. He seemed apologetic, but Kyle also appeared angry as hell. "This wasn't our doing, Alex. Durham blindsided us this time. The chief of police made the decision himself. There's political pressure right up to the State House on this thing. Something smells so bad I want to put a handkerchief over my nose and mouth." "What the hell did they find in the house?" I asked Kyle. "What physical evidence? Not the dirty books." Kyle shook his head. "Women's underwear. He had a large cache of clothes hidden in the house. There was a University of North Carolina t-shirt that belonged to Kate McTiernan. Casanova apparently kept souvenirs, too, just like the gentleman in L.A. "He wouldn't do that. He's different from the gentleman," I said to Kyle. "He has the girls and plenty of their clothes at his hideaway. He's careful and obsessive about it." "Kyle, this is fucking crazy. This isn't the answer. This is a huge mess-up." "You don't know that for sure," Kyle said. "Good theories aren't going to stop this from happening. How about good logic and a little common sense?" "That won't work either, I'm afraid." We started to walk toward the back porch of the Sachs house. TV cameras whirred in action, shooting anything that moved. It was a full-scale three-ring media circus, a disaster of the highest order in progress. "They searched the house sometime late this afternoon," Kyle told me as we walked. "Brought dogs in. Special dogs from Georgia." "Why the hell would they do that? Why suddenly search the Sachs house now? God damn it!" "They received a tip, and they had reason to believe it. That's what I'm getting from them. I'm on the outside, too, Alex. I don't like it any more than you do." I could barely see 2 feet ahead of me. My vision was tunneled. Stress will do that. Anger, too. I wanted to shout, to scream out at somebody. I wanted to punch out lights on the Sachs's veranda-style porch. "Did they tell you anything about this anonymous tipster?" "Jesus Christ, Kyle. God damn it to hell, an anonymous tip? Aw, God damn it!" Wick Sachs was being held hostage inside his own beautiful house. The Durham police apparently wanted this historic moment recorded on local and national TV. This was it for them. North Carolina law enforcement, Hall of Fame time. They had the wrong man, and they wanted to show him off to the world. Chapter 100. I recognized the Durham chief of police right away. He was in his early 40s and looked like an ex-pro quarterback. Chief Robbie Hatfield was around 6'2", square-jawed, powerfully built. I had a wild, paranoid thought that maybe he was Casanova. He looked the part anyway. He even fit the psych profile of Casanova. Detectives Sykes and Ruskin were flanking the prisoner, Dr. Wick Sachs. I recognized a couple of other Durham detectives. They all appeared nervous as hell, but jubilant and mostly relieved. Sachs looked as if he'd taken a shower in his clothes. He looked guilty. "Are you Casanova? Are you the beast after all? If so, what the hell are you pulling now?" I wanted to ask Sachs 100 questions, but couldn't. Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes joked around some with their brother officers in the crowded foyer. The two detectives reminded me of a few professional jocks I'd known around D.C. Most of them liked the spotlight. Some of them lived for it. Most of the Durham police force seemed to operate like that, too. Ruskin's hair was shiny and slicked back, combed back tight against his skull. He was ready for the spotlight, I could see. Davy Sykes looked ready, too. "You two bozos should be checking your list of doctor suspects," I wanted to tell them. "This thing isn't over, it's just starting now. The real Casanova is cheering for you right now. Maybe he's watching from the crowd." I made my way up closer to Wick Sachs. I needed to see everything here, just as it was, feel it, watch and listen to it, understand it somehow. Sachs's wife and the two beautiful children were being kept in the dining room off the vestibule. They looked hurt, very sad and confused. They knew something was wrong here, too. The Sachs family didn't look guilty. Chief Robbie Hatfield and Davy Sykes finally saw me. Sykes reminded me of the chief's favorite bird dog. He was pointing at me now. "Dr. Cross, thank you for your help on all this." Chief Hatfield was magnanimous in his moment of triumph. I had forgotten that I was the one here who'd brought back the photo of Sachs from the gentleman's apartment in Los Angeles. Such great detective work.
Such a convenient goddamn clue to discover. This was all wrong. It just felt wrong and it smelled wrong. This was a setup of the First Order and it was working perfectly. Casanova was escaping. He was getting away right now. He would never be caught. The Durham chief of police finally put out his hand. I took the chief's hand and squeezed it tight, held on to it. I think he was afraid I was going to walk out into the camera lights with him. Robbie Hatfield had seemed like a hands-off administrator up until now. He and his star detectives were about to parade Wicksax outside. It would be a big, dazzling moment under a full moon in the blazing Klieg lights. All that was missing were the baying bloodhounds. I know I helped find him, but Wicksax didn't do it, I told Hatfield straight to his face. You're arresting the wrong man. Let me tell you why. Give me 10 minutes right now. He smiled at me, and it seemed like a goddamn condescending smile. It was almost as if he were stoned in the moment. Chief Hatfield pulled away from me and walked outside. He walked out in front of the bright TV camera lights, playing his part beautifully. He was so taken with himself that he almost forgot about Sachs. Whoever called about the women's underwear is Casanova, I was thinking to myself. I was getting closer in my mind to who that might be. Casanova did this. Casanova is behind it, anyway. Dr. Wicksax passed by me as they led him outside. He was dressed in a white cotton shirt and black trousers. All of his fine clothes were drenched through with his sweat. I imagined he was swimming in his shoes, too, gold-buckled black loafers. His hands were cuffed behind his back. All of his arrogance was long gone. "I didn't do anything," he said to me in the softest, choking voice. His eyes were pleading. He couldn't believe this either. Then he said the most pathetic thing of all. "I don't hurt women. I love them." I was struck with a mad, absolutely dizzying thought on the Sachs porch. I felt as if I were in the middle of a somersault, and then I just stopped. Time stopped. "This is Casanova," I suddenly understood. Wicksax was the original model used for Casanova, anyway. That was the monster's plan from the start. They had a fall guy for their perfect murders and the Desaad-like adventures. Dr. Wicksax was actually Casanova, but he wasn't one of the monsters. Casanova was a front, too. He knew nothing about the real Collector. He was another victim. Chapter 101 "I'm the gentleman caller," Will Rudolph announced with a polite, theatrical bow. He was wearing a dinner jacket, black tie, dress shirt. His hair was tied in a tight ponytail. He'd bought white roses for the special occasion. "And you know who I am, ladies. You all look so very lovely," Casanova spoke at his side. He was a striking contrast to his partner. Tight black jeans, black cowboy boots, no shirt. His stomach washboard hard. He had on a black fright mask with thick, hand-painted median gray streaks. The killers introduced themselves as the women filed into the living room at the hideaway. They lined up in front of a long table. This was to be a special celebration, they had been informed earlier in the day. "The mad dog Casanova has finally been caught," Casanova told them. "It's all over the news. Turned out that he was some crazed college professor. Who can you trust these days?" The women had been asked to wear serious party clothes, whatever they would choose for a special night out. Gowns with plunging necklines, high-heeled evening shoes with sheer stockings, and perhaps pearls or long earrings. No other jewelry. They were to look elegant. "Only 7 pretty ladies here now," Rudolph noted, as he and Casanova watched the women enter the living room and form a receiving line. "You're too picky, you know. And the original Casanova was a voracious lover who wasn't choosy at all." "You have to admit that the 7 are extraordinary," Casanova said to his friend. "My collection is a masterpiece, the best in the world." "I quite agree with you," said the gentleman. "They look like paintings. Shall we begin?" They had agreed to play an old favorite game, Lucky 7.
At other times it had been Lucky 4, Lucky 11, Lucky 2. It was the gentleman's game, actually. This was his night, perhaps the final night at the house for the two of them. They calmly walked down the receiving line. They talked with Melissa